Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with political uncertainty in the UK following an inconclusive election that was another catastrophic miscalculation by a Conservative leader following David Cameron's fateful miscalculation to call for the Brexit referendum. Craig Calhoun, the Global Distinguished Professor at New York University and Centennial Professor and former head of the London School of Economics, who is now the president of the Berggruen Institute, joins us. We will discuss whether Prime Minister Theresa May, who former Tory Chancellor George Osborne called a dead woman walking, can put together a government with the DUP, the tiny ultra-conservative Northern Ireland Unionist Party, and whether in doing so she will undermine the Good Friday Agreement that has brought peace between the north and south of Ireland, which could be threatened by putting up a wall along a border that has been largely erased by cross-border commerce. Then we'll examine whether there is a real possibility of an impeachment against President Trump happening soon as a special counsel, Robert Mueller, begins an investigation that is impacted daily by new revelations in the press, not to mention recent testimony by fired FBI Director Comey and contradictory claims by Trump that Comey both vindicated him in his testimony and lied. Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and was a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office, joins us to offer a practical assessment of the complexity and duration of Mueller's investigation that may be completed around the time of the 2018 elections. Then finally, we'll look into the explosion of hate and ignorance erupting around the country as March Against Sharia demonstrations took place in St. Paul, Seattle, Washington, New York City, and San Bernardino, California, attracting counter-demonstrations that led to violence and a massive deployment of police to separate the sides. Brian Levin, a criminologist, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss why a non-existent threat such as Sharia law is inspiring right-wing hate groups to emerge from the fringes. And joining us now is Craig Calhoun, who is the Global Distinguished Professor at New York University and the Centennial Professor and former head of the London School of Economics. He's now the president of the Berggruen Institute, whose mission is to develop foundational ideas and shape political, economic, and social institutions for the 21st century. The Berggruen Institute confers the Berggruen Prize, a $1 million annual award given by an independent jury to a thinker whose ideas are helping to shape human self-understanding and advance humankind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Calhoun.
Good to talk with you, Ian.
And things are really in disarray in the UK. And it feels like there's sort of a serial miscalculation here in the terms of what just happened with the snap election that Prime Minister Theresa May announced. And then rather than increase her majority from 17, it's shrunk considerably. But there was, of course, a prior miscalculation on the part of her predecessor, David Cameron. So is this going to further alienate the electorate in general from political leaders? Because there is a sense of a great deal of alienation in the UK.
Well, I think there are two big things going on here, Ian. One of them is the arrogance and complacency of leaders who take fairly reckless decisions to call for elections or referenda without a clear need to do so, and largely to deal with their inside the party struggles for power rather than broader national needs. And then the second one follows from that, which is that people in the country get annoyed at having elections that don't seem to respond mainly to national needs and core national issues, but instead to party political squabbles. So yes, this is part of a process that has alienated growing numbers of voters. It's also mobilized a lot of voters, though. The young people who voted Labour are enthusiastically voting Labour. They're not just saying lesser of two evils.
And they seem to be motivated by the Brexit disruption. And it does seem that there's a cultural, if not generational, divide there between those that perhaps were nostalgic for the empire. It's hard to know exactly why people voted for Brexit. But it seems that the young really, they want to be part of Europe.
Absolutely. There's clearly a generational divide. The old voted disproportionately for Brexit and in fairly large numbers, and they voted disproportionately for Theresa May and the Conservatives, though perhaps without the same turnout. And the young voted in a weak turnout against Brexit, but in a strong turnout for Jeremy Corbyn. This, of course, reinforces broader cultural and geographic divisions, basically between parts of the country that are thriving economically and creating opportunities for young people, particularly in a few cities, and the rest of the country, which has been in shakier condition.
So is there a possibility of a do-over? I know the Liberal Democrats are calling for one, but since they haven't pulled the trigger on the two-year period to get this divorce from Europe, is there any chance, do you think? I mean, I know it's hard to predict with the political turmoil going on, which we'll certainly talk about in a minute, but what's your sense of whether this incredible, what seems to me at least to be an historic mistake of massive proportions, it's hard to understand how it happened and why it happened, but it's happened and some are resigned to it, but now it seems like there's a bit of pushback.
A do-over of the Brexit vote is possible, but I wouldn't say that it's at all likely. Neither of the two big parties is really pushing for it. The Scottish Nationalist Party actually got pushed back. It's hard to say where the local politics in Britain comes from to make the decision. Whose interest is it in among the political leaders to really push this? That said, I think there are a lot of people in the country who would vote differently if they got the chance.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Calhoun, who is the Global Distinguished Professor at New York University and the Centennial Professor and former head of London School of Economics, and he's now the president of the Berggruen Institute. So let's look at this turmoil now. You've got Theresa May hanging by a thread. She's trying to form a coalition government with the Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, which is extremely conservative. And there's some talk that this will put the Good Friday Agreement in some jeopardy. The Queen's speech is due on the 19th of June. You've got Jeremy Corbyn more or less saying he can still somehow become Prime Minister, and he's asking for other parties to join him. I don't know whether the numbers make any sense. Labour gained 30 seats to take a total of 262, but the Conservatives are still the biggest party in Parliament with 318 seats. You need 326 with the 10 DUP seats. Of course, they could form a government. So let's start with that. Is Corbyn, you know, sort of boasting? Somebody actually within his own party is quite critical of him, saying he had an own goal, use a soccer analogy, and he missed the kick. But in general, there's no chance that he can form a Parliament, is there? She has a much greater chance, even if it's going to be a very weak Parliament.
I think it's a long shot that Labour can form a government, but here's the story. The Conservatives get the first chance because they're the largest party. Because they're a minority, they have to get a partner to get over the level needed for a majority. They've chosen the Democratic Unionist Party, which is not just conservative, it's reactionary, and therefore will alienate some of the more moderate conservative supporters who don't like to think of themselves as being in a coalition with such a far right-wing party. The question then is, will any of those discontented conservative members of parliament break ranks and not vote for the government? I think that's not very likely. I think they will all vote for the government. There's also a possibility that they can't make the deal with the DUP, but again, I think that's remote, because I think cynically they want to be in power, so they will make that happen. It's only if that falls apart for some reason that Corbyn gets a chance, and then he would have to put together a coalition, which is not impossible, with the Scottish Nationalists, the Lib Dems, possibly Greens or others, to form a very narrow majority.
Well, the head of the DUP, Mrs. Foster, is meeting with Theresa May on Tuesday. Since they are the kingmakers, this tiny party with 10 seats, yep. Clearly they're relishing that position, aren't they?
Sure. Yeah. And they ran on this. They intended to become kingmakers. They said, let us hold the balance of power, vote for us. So they didn't run with a smashing success, but that was their very platform, that they would be in this position. Northern Ireland is itself in turmoil and with huge amounts of anxiety. The DUP is the largest but not the majority party. There is a great deal of worry over Brexit and the possibility that there will again be a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. There's also a great deal of worry over the fact that England seems to have paid no attention to Northern Ireland in making its decisions about the future of the country. And there's a great deal of worry over the fact that the Unionist Party is such a reactionary party, and a concern that this will lead to a variety of kinds of social problems, not just a return possibly of some of the older troubles between Catholics and Protestants, but the fact that they are as homophobic and as biased on other issues as they seem to be.
So there'll be two things at play here. The former minister, I think, who put in Blair's government, put together the Good Friday Agreement. He's quite concerned about reigniting yep. those troubles. But on the other hand, since the Southern Ireland, the Republic, is part of the EU, and the Northern Ireland would be then not a part of the EU, and they're the biggest trading partners, there must be an economic incentive there for the more pragmatic people to want to keep that trade agreement going.
There's a very strong economic incentive for ordinary people in Northern Ireland to want to trade with the South. But it goes beyond just, if you will, the big picture economy of trade statistics. It's a very immediate and local thing, because they don't want to have a fortified, armed border where you have to stop and go through border checks when they drive half an hour to go to the supermarket. And all along the border, there are people going back and forth now. The border is more or less invisible. So people go to get a carton of eggs. And on the other side, there are people selling their eggs. So this is a very personal and immediate anxiety. At the very least, it will be an inconvenience, but way beyond inconvenience, it will be a division, a sore spot, and a frustration.
So is that the metaphor for this era, the Trump era, if you will, building walls? I know the Pope took him on about saying, you know, we should be building bridges, not walls. But my understanding is that a lot of xenophobia was generated in the Brexit, lead up to the Brexit vote, particularly with Europe being flooded by refugees from Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. So the idea that this is going to bring back walls, there again, I guess you've got the generational. The young people don't want walls and the older people do. Is that, and also added to that, of course, is the fact that my understanding is that British authorities are now suggesting that Donald Trump's visit should be postponed.
Well, Donald Trump seems to be suggesting it should be postponed if he's going to face protesters. I think the issue is partly one of xenophobia and renewed nationalism, but to be clear, not in Northern Ireland. It's not the case that Northern Ireland voted for Brexit, and it's not the case that there is majority support for a hard border with the Republic of Ireland. So in Northern Ireland, there is not any wave of support for nationalism or xenophobia, and there is not any great support for a hard border or a wall. That support is in England, some considerable distance away. And so what we see is an English anxiety being played out on Northern Irish political issues and soil.
Well, this would suggest then that given the disproportionate influence that this tiny DUP party will have, wouldn't that mean then that the very progress that you're talking about that's been made in this seamless union or disunion is going to be exacerbated by this reactionary party?
Yeah. The progress is not going to be exacerbated. It's going to be contradicted.
Okay.
I think the likelihood is that the conservative alliance with the DUP will damage the situation in Northern Ireland, increase conflict. At the same time, it's going to alienate a number of voters in the rest of Great Britain. Think of Scotland, which also voted against Brexit, but faces having the will of the English imposed on it in being forced to leave the European Union. And think of the large number of people, especially young people, throughout England who didn't want to have Brexit and who didn't want to have Theresa May. So having Theresa May, courtesy of the DUP, is going to make that even more galling.
Well, turning to Brexit itself, I've never been able to figure out how it all happened. And the people that made it happen seemed so marginal, like Nigel Farage. Of course, Boris Johnson also played a part, and he's now the foreign minister. But there have been some reporting from The Guardian indicating that there was a role, in a significant role played by the biggest financial backer of Donald Trump, the Mercers, and a company called Cambridge Analytica that did all the data mining through social media and did some very targeting. In effect, the case has been made that that Brexit was a dress rehearsal for the Trump campaign. As we know, Trump spent infinitely less than Hillary Clinton and still managed to eke out a victory, apparently largely due to the use of targeting via social media through these sophisticated algorithms that Mercers have developed. So have you figured out how it all happened? It just seemed like one of those accidents of history.
Well, I think there's both a big picture and a narrower picture. The narrower picture is the reasons why David Cameron and colleagues thought it was a good idea to call for this referendum. And they were doing that to make sure they had a strong position in the Conservative Party and that they were able to stop Nigel Farage and others, the UK Independence Party, from biting at their right wing. And so they were worried about simply having their majority win, which they got a year ago. And they promised the referendum, and they were pretty sure that the referendum would not pass. They didn't pay close attention to how they drafted it. So when I say the smaller picture, there are all sorts of details. They did not consult constitutional lawyers. They did not frame the actual referendum proposition very well. And they didn't run a good campaign. They just tried to frighten people. So there's that story of the referendum. There's a bigger story about why are people even thinking about such things, which has partly to do with some genuine issues and concerns about Europe, and very largely to do with scapegoating immigrants and refugees for economic and other problems, and somewhat to do with a general sense that Britain ought to be a bigger, stronger, more prestigious global power, and somehow it could be if it were independent. It's that last part that is especially anticipating Donald Trump and his America First campaign, and the same sort of issue with scapegoating immigrants for something that's a bigger, more complicated process that includes automation and industrial change and the globalization of markets and a variety of things that create a very interdependent world that make old-fashioned claims to sovereignty no longer work in quite the same way. And all of that goes into the picture. Now you raise social media on top of this and sheer political manipulation. And there's certainly some of it on each side of the Atlantic. I think in this case, there's way more in the Trump camp. The Trump election owes a lot more to social media than either of the recent UK elections, where social media was certainly used, but less. All the research suggests it just didn't play as big a role. Was it a dress rehearsal? Did Cambridge Analytica get involved? Probably. But it probably wasn't decisive.
So just to look at the situation now, and as we mentioned, looking ahead with this two-year divorce process that still hasn't been triggered, and we mentioned earlier the possibility, as the Liberal Democrats have suggested, that you could get a do-over. You think that's unlikely. But perhaps there is some analogies with what's happening here in the United States in terms of Trump's constituency. There's a huge divide in this country, obviously, and the theory is that, well, let me put it this way. A recent poll by ABC, Washington Post, indicated that something like 89% of Trump's followers here in the United States believe he is honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his campaign promises. And 78% of his followers believe that the mainstream media propagates fake news. So that's that sort of silo that exists there.
Yep.
And the theory is that what will chip away at that, and when will these people get buyer's remorse, if indeed, as it appears to be, that Trump is not going to deliver? even though he's made an effort with things like Paris, but he still hasn't built his wall, etc. So yeah. Is a similar situation in the UK? In other words, my understanding is that the City of London's not going to be too happy about Brexit and the economy may tank. And under those conditions, will there be enough buyer's remorse on the part of the people that voted for Brexit to enable a do-over?
There is certainly some buyer's remorse, and there certainly is more mobilization of people on the pro-Remain side than there was during the campaign when it was needed. But my guess is there's not enough of either of those to produce the do-over. And in the United States, the same thing. I think it's less a theory that there is going to be a replay of the election than a wild hope that some people have. I think that Trump's support in his own base remains relatively strong. Unless his support falls below something like 30%, I don't think you're going to see that really deeply challenge him. The Republican control of government is very strong, and it's not just things like they got the withdrawal from the Paris Accord. The big thing they got is Gorsuch. The big thing they got is a Supreme Court justice. And for many Trump supporters who made a cynical bargain, people who say they are in favor of morality, evangelical Christians, Catholics, and others, there was a fairly cynical calculation. We will elect this immoral president, but he will give us something that we really, really want, which is a Supreme Court justice who will not vote for abortion rights and, in general, will not vote to expand government policy in areas where we don't like it. So I think that there are more people who are, if not satisfied, at least willing to tolerate the situation. And then finally, add to this the fact that the Republican members of Congress who are up for election in less than 2 years are all worried about primary opponents. They're not just worried about whether Democrats might beat them in the general election. They're worried about whether the Tea Party and the far right of the Republican Party will challenge them in primaries, potentially defeat them, or at least force them to spend a lot of money and effort fighting that challenge. And 45 U.S. states have laws that you can't run in the general election as an independent if you lose in your party's primary. So moderate Republicans have pretty strong incentives to go along with a government that they really don't like.
It's pretty hard to imagine that there are people further to the right than some of the incumbents, but I take your point. But surely, just in closing, when you talk about the morality voters and the Christians who made that bargain with the immoral Donald Trump, back waiting in the wings, of course, is the very moral Mike Pence. So is there a calculus there that maybe, you know, he's brought us to the dance and we don't need him anymore?
Some people may think like that, and I think that a number of liberals are failing to consider the implications of a Pence presidency with Republican control of Congress. And I think in general there is a confusion between being worried about Donald Trump because he's undignified and embarrassing, and being worried about Donald Trump because he is introducing bad policies and making erratic decisions. And those who are in opposition to Trump would do well to focus on the second, on the real policy considerations and the damage being done, and not just be embarrassed by the fact that he's their president.
Well, Craig Calhoun, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Craig Calhoun, who's a Global Distinguished Professor at New York University and the Centennial Professor and the former head of the London School of Economics. He's now the president of the Berggruen Institute, whose mission is to develop foundational ideas and shape political, economic, and social institutions for the 21st century. The Berggruen Institute confers the Berggruen Prize, a $1 million annual award given by an independent jury to a thinker whose ideas are helping to shape human self-understanding and advance humankind.
And we're going to take a brief station break and be back examining whether there's a real possibility of an impeachment against President Trump happening soon.
Come together, right. that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Kern Griffin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And let's talk about, start out talking about the broad political landscape here. To some extent, James Comey tried to point this out in his testimony recently, where he made the point that in his conversation with Donald Trump, there was never any concern expressed on the part of Donald Trump about what Russia has done to the United States in terms of the attack on the very foundation of American democracy by meddling in our elections. And across the board, that seems to be a lot of denial on the part of the normally conservative Republican, you know, the people that were Cold Warriors during the Cold War and Red Baiters even. They seem to be making excuses for the Russians, which is peculiar. And then on the left, you have people who normally are suspicious of the CIA, hoping somehow that the CIA is going to find the evidence, the smoking gun, to impeach Donald Trump. So do you find, in general, our political landscape a little confusing?
I don't know that I find it confusing, but I do think that much of what is happening is about politics and not specifically about the legal issues on which most people are focusing. The movement, ultimately, in terms of outcomes in this investigation, is going to turn on the political landscape at least as much as it turns on whatever legal conclusions the special counsel draws.
But in terms of our national security, if you will, do you find that puzzling, that that seems to be less of an issue? The politics have transcended the traditional concerns about national security.
I think it's true that politics are transcending a lot of concerns about national security and a lot of the traditional political alignment that one might expect. And if it's true, as reported, that the White House is not particularly focused on the threat to national security or the counterintelligence implications of the investigation and only on the political ones, then that indeed is a matter of great concern.
So let's turn to the idea that there's an investment in impeachment in terms of the opposition to Donald Trump. And of course, there were 3 million more votes cast for the loser, which is a little paradoxical, but nevertheless a fact. And as we know, the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump, there was massive demonstration. So there's no question that there's a resistance out there. How much is that resistance, do you think, Lisa, how much do you think it's predicated upon on a bit of an illusion that somehow you can, because you think this guy is so bad, that he could be impeached?
I do think that it's a mistake to think of impeachment as an electoral strategy. It is not intended as a way to overturn the results of an election or to express political resistance. It's an extraordinary remedy intended to remove from office someone who has shown themselves to be engaged in criminal activity or manifestly unfit to hold that office, rather than someone with whom the majority of the country disagrees.
And do you think that there is any possibility then of, if the elections in 2018 go badly for the Republicans with a Democratic House, because it's not really, impeachment is not necessarily driven by legal considerations. The Founding Fathers placed it in the political realm, did they not?
They did. It's a political action and a political remedy. And I think that it's correct to imagine the 2018 midterm elections as the likely crucible of this crisis, because the investigation that the special counsel is conducting is going to take a long time, months, maybe even years. There's a temptation, because the news has moved so quickly, to think that some explosive development is going to propel the investigation to a quick conclusion. But that's not the kind of investigation that it is, and it's not the kind of investigator Robert Mueller is. And they're going to be exquisitely careful, and they're going to take their time. And the time that they take may well coincide with the electoral politics of the midterms in 2018. And if that is the case, and the findings are being revealed around the time that power is changing hands in at least one branch of Congress, then that is probably, yes, the intersection of the most important aspects of this political moment.
But is it possible, though, that, and clearly things move fast in terms of the press, there's a lot of clearly resources that the New York Times and the Washington Post are putting into investigating Trump and the Russian connection. But there will be, there's some doubt about, it's not entirely clear, that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, will be testifying on Tuesday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I don't know whether Donald Trump has asked him to do this or told him to do this or whether he's volunteered, as has been reported. But assuming he does testify, surely he will be asked, will he not, about the meetings, etc., that took place. But in the context of what Donald Trump said the other day with the Romanian president, standing by the Romanian president in the Rose Garden, where he basically said that Comey's a liar, and then he played this kind of reality TV game about the tapes, whether or not, teasing the journalists whether or not tapes exist. Won't that be the focus of questioning? And if the Attorney General of the United States can't deliver a cogent and truthful and realistic answer about these tapes, whether or not they exist, let's say, for example, that it's proven that they don't exist. Is that something that's going to really hurt Trump? I mean, what does it take, I guess? That's at the heart of my question. What does it take?
I think in terms of what it takes at this point, the answer to that question lies in the very capable hands of Robert Mueller. I think that events of recent months have demonstrated that the most extraordinary violations of political norms and protocols are not going to be sufficient in terms of changing the power dynamics with respect to the support that President Trump has. I think one of two things could happen. As I mentioned, significant electoral disadvantage for the Republicans, which would change the level of support that he has and might change the course of his presidency, or findings by the special counsel that reveal activity with which no one could fail to find fault. One of those two things will happen. As far as whether the Attorney General is going to answer questions about the tapes, that remains to be seen. Who knows? I think Congress has learned in the course of these hearings that sometimes they don't get answers to their questions, even when officials appear in front of them and purport to answer them. So we'll have to see what he's willing to address in his testimony, what he chooses to put off, and what he may, you know, assert some privilege not to answer.
So what would the calculus be in having him testify, assuming that this was something that Trump wanted, which I'm assuming is the case?
I don't know. I don't think we know what the motivations are for the testimony. It's just being reported that he's willing to testify. It may be that his credibility was put into question sufficiently by Director Comey's testimony that he feels that he needs to remedy that. It may be that there's a significant amount of pressure to answer some of the questions that have been raised. But candidly, I don't know what his motivations are, who's directing him to testify.
But in general, since you have been a U.S. attorney, federal prosecutor, and you clerk for a Supreme Court justice who is sorely missed, many people feel, because you're one of those rare, I think, exceptional justices who actually had legislative experience. But in general, Donald Trump has been fairly hostile to the judiciary. And in terms of the law enforcement, he's been very dismissive of the FBI, and of course that prompted Comey in his opening statements to call Trump a liar, specifically saying that he lied about what disarray the FBI was in, etc., and how it was poorly led. Obviously that was quite personal for Comey. So in general, my sense is that Donald Trump is not making himself popular with the judiciary, whether it's conservative or liberal, by talking about so-called judges, etc. Do you detect any kind of disquiet in the judiciary? It is a third branch of government. Sometimes Stephen Miller in the White House has indicated a lack of knowledge of the importance of this third branch and the independence of it. Just a broad question. Is there some disquiet in the judiciary in general, if you can assess such a thing?
I think there is disquiet among constitutional law scholars about what seem to be some fundamental misunderstandings about our government's structure. The judiciary is not a branch or a group from whom you're going to hear expressions of disquiet outside of the context of the decisions that they render. So what their personal or political feelings are not generally going to be the subject of any statements that are accessible to the public, and that's how it should be.
Well, there are reports, of course, that many, many Republican senators and congressmen are expressing in private their disquiet about Donald Trump and his behavior.
Well, those are legislators, yes.
Right, I understand.
Who are elected and who, but as far as the federal judiciary goes, who are not elected and who, under Article 3 of the Constitution, serve with life tenure, they're generally speaking going to be very reluctant to express anything publicly that constitutes a political belief. Some judges have spoken out about the importance of the rule of law and the importance of an independent judiciary in very general terms, but it would be unusual for them to say anything specifically outside of the context of a particular decision, such as the decision on the travel ban, that could be construed as a political statement.
So in terms of then the law enforcement community, particularly the FBI, and of course added to Donald Trump's attacks on the FBI or on Comey specifically, he also has disparaged the intelligence community in general, the CIA in particular, calling them a bunch of Nazis, etc. Is there any detectable pushback from that community?
I think most of the public statements that constitute pushback on those sorts of attacks have come from former members of the intelligence community and former members of the federal law enforcement community. It wouldn't really be ordinary or appropriate for current members of federal law enforcement to speak out. They're part of the executive branch, and they're not going to be making any public statements that are critical of other members of the executive branch. And indeed, there are some internal rules that prohibit political involvement and political statements. So that would be very unusual, and I don't think that you will hear, other than, again, general expressions of professionalism and support for colleagues, from current intelligence officials or federal law enforcement officers. But Director Comey is a private citizen now, and it was really quite extraordinary, the specter of his testimony. A very recently terminated director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation criticizing a sitting president. That's an almost unprecedented moment in American history and was really quite momentous. But it was possible only because he's now a private citizen and would not have occurred when he was director of the FBI.
And what was your impression then of the efforts on the part of some of the Republican senators to pick apart some of his testimony? It didn't seem to be particularly successful, but basically suggest that, and as Donald Trump, this is the surreal part of it, Donald Trump in his Rose Garden statements a couple of days ago basically said he was exonerated. And there's obviously a inconsistency there. On the one part, he said basically saying that Comey's a liar, but on the other part, he's saying that Comey exonerated me. So, you know, Comey is both credible and not credible, according to Trump's inconsistent statements. So,
well, there's both an inconsistency and a misapprehension there. So the inconsistency is the one that you've pointed out, one that was pointed out, frankly, by Director Comey's own responses to why his testimony should be viewed as credible. And as you said, you need to take the testimony as a whole, the things that are good and the things that are bad for any given side. But the misapprehension is that the president is in any way exonerated because at a particular point in the timeline of an incredibly complex investigation, there wasn't an open counterintelligence case against the president personally. It's a mistake to view that fact, which has now been testified to under oath by Director Comey, as an exoneration. It is just a statement of fact about the status of one particular individual in at one particular point in time at the beginning of a very complex investigation.
And that complex investigation, you're suggesting, and you have a few minutes ago suggested, will take a lot of time, and that those that are expecting a speedy impeachment may be disappointed. But assuming that, as we talked earlier about, it may come out around the time of the 2018 elections, either before or during or after, but that's reasonable to speculate that by then there may be some conclusion. How much do you think it could be limited in terms of the explosive nature, again, the expectation on the part of the what we could call the resistance, that there will be a smoking gun? Isn't it true that in these counterintelligence investigations, it's quite possible that a lot of the really damaging evidence was obtained through national technical means and other sources and methods that the intelligence community will simply not want revealed in open court? So is it possible that the case against Donald Trump's surrogates and possibly he himself could be limited by that national security requirement?
I think that it is the case that there will be things about the investigation that we do not, cannot, and should not know. And I think that people have to be patient about that. It's also the case, for example, that Robert Mueller can obtain access as needed to the president's tax returns. And if he does do that, he will keep them very confidential. And that him gaining access to information doesn't mean that the public is entitled to access to that information or will ever see them. But I think that people should have confidence that Director Mueller and his really extraordinary team, Michael Dreeben, Andrew Weissman, the team that he is assembling are deeply professional, highly experienced, and incredibly careful. And they're going to get to the bottom of the financial irregularities, the national security dimensions, the potential political corruption, whatever there is, if there's anything, they will find it. And what the public needs to know, they will find out at the appropriate time. And they will do that work without regard to the parallel electoral process that ordinarily prosecutors attempt to avoid bringing charges around the time of elections and to stay out of electoral politics. So they're not going to be doing their work with an eye toward impacting any particular political situation. That they'll carefully avoid that. And they're also going to do it separately from the extraordinary investigative journalism that has been going on at the same time. And in the process of that investigative journalism, there may be some explosive developments or some further leaks of information that the public finds very interesting, and that may generate impatience about why it isn't creating some formal charges or impeachment proceedings. But those are three different tracks. What the public is finding out through the media, what the special counsel is doing with his team, and what is happening in the political branches, in the congressional hearings, and ultimately in term elections.
Well, just in the last minute then, Lisa Kern Griffin, you're confident then that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, will be able to get hold of Donald Trump's tax returns?
If he needs to, if there is a demonstrated need for them in the context of his investigation, if, for example, understanding the connections to the relevant parties requires an understanding of any financial entanglements, and those would be revealed by the tax returns, yes, they're carefully protected documents. And, of course, he will have to have a demonstrated need and issue the appropriate subpoena. But he doesn't have to tell Donald Trump that he wants them, and he doesn't need to reveal them. He would certainly not reveal them. They would be kept very carefully secured and very confidential, and only shown to a narrow group of individuals working on the investigation on an as-needed basis. But yes, of course, the law provides for him to get them as the special counsel if he decides that that's relevant and necessary.
Well, Lisa Kern Griffin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
I did too. And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Kern Griffin, who's a professor of law at Duke University, who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. And again, we'd take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the explosion of hate and ignorance erupting around the country as March Against Sharia demonstrations took place in St. Paul, Seattle, Washington, New York City, and San Bernardino, California.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, he served as the associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittees on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me again, Ian. And just one quick note. I've seen Michael Dreeben argue before the Supreme Court, and he's pretty stellar.
And you're referring to the new attorney that Robert Mueller has taken on to investigate the Trump-Russia connections.
Yes, he was very impressive. He was arguing in a couple of cases where I wrote some Amici briefs. But anyway, sorry to take you off topic.
No. But let's talk about you in the midst of this demonstration in San Bernardino. And of course, I mentioned there were demonstrations around the country in St. Paul, Seattle, Washington, New York City. But the local demonstration in San Bernardino took place in front of the Inland Regional Center, the IRC, where, of course, people were murdered recently in a terrorist attack. I take it that one of your board members on the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, Trena Means, she lost her husband, Damien, in that terrorist attack. And, of course, he was the father of two daughters. Let me start out by just reading her statement about what took place in a sense desecrating the memory of her husband, because the demonstrations, these anti-Sharia demonstrations in San Bernardino took place in front of the Inland Recreational Center. She said, "As Americans, we are blessed to live in a representative democracy with a constitutionally mandated separation of church and state. Sharia law, as this group misunderstands it, is not present, nor will it be imposed in the United States. This rally seems to be a thinly veiled, bizarre excuse to spread religious bigotry and racist propaganda. We do not support this, and we are deeply disappointed that this site, which is so important to us, was chosen as the location for this misguided and unfortunate event. As a family, we strongly condemn any acts of hatred or intolerance. One horrific act of hatred has already occurred at the Inland Regional Center. There is no need for more. We seek peace, not further divisive acts. We will never support any event or action that is not rooted in compassion and love." Powerful message, clearly lost on those that participated in this peculiar idea that somehow Sharia law is about to take over the United States.
Yeah, people have the right to wound with words and wound with free expression, but you know, in our society, we don't want the government deciding where messages can be stated and what viewpoints can be expressed. That being said, as an ethical function, it would have been nice to have this somewhere else.
So what do you think, though, Brian Levin, is happening in the nation in general? Is why are these groups coming out of the woodwork, and why are they rallying around such an absurd and ignorant notion of Sharia law? Because quite simply, I mean, we know that some of these states in Oklahoma and Kansas, et cetera, have preemptively passed anti-Sharia laws as though there was even any possibility that somehow it could be imposed on, you know, in the United States. So I'm just curious to know why they're coalescing around such a, you know, absurd fantasy.
You know, it's a great question, and there was really a spectrum of people on both sides with regard to these issues. Let's backtrack. I think there are three things that are affecting anti-Muslim bigotry in the United States, and we have the latest data in the United States on hate crime. And we did some research that showed in 2016, out of 25 large cities and counties, actually we're up to about 26 now, there was about a 6% increase in hate crime, and we're talking about crimes now, not incidents, where it appears that they may be going up even more, but our data is more solid on the criminal side of things. But in California, we had a 14% increase, and that would be the first time that we would see a back-to-back increase in hate crime since 1996. And nationally, it would be the first time since about 2004 if this 6% increase holds. What was interesting is the larger states like New York and California, and we don't have all the jurisdictions, were much higher than the rest of the country. New York had a 20% increase in hate crime. Moreover, we saw that in five of the six cities that actually broke it down, anti-Muslim hate crimes were up. Mercifully, in L.A., anti-Muslim hate crimes went down. But in 2015, we had a 67% increase nationally in anti-Muslim hate crime. So bottom line is, we're talking about a rise on top of a rise. And so far, for the limited number of cities, we only have about maybe five cities or so, Seattle, New York, Chicago, Long Beach, they're all ahead of where they were year to date at various cutoffs for hate crime in 2017. So we're having this rise in hate crime, but behind that, we also have about 40%+ of Americans admitting in various polls that was published in places like Social Forces and others to having some anti-Muslim prejudice. So Muslims are the most disdained, socially recognizable group in the United States, now outpacing atheists. On top of that, we've had some terrible terrorist attacks, and we've had bigotry from a small sliver of extremists who actually also are bigoted against other Muslims. But it's all tied together where there are folks who believe that Muslims represent some undifferentiated pool of extremists and would-be terrorists. So then on top of that, you pour the gasoline of a socio-political coalescence of a movement that labels Muslims as incompatible with American society, and Sharia law is that bayonet that's doing it.
And we have a president, of course, who says we got to ban Muslims, we've got to keep them out. There's something going on here. He's not exactly pouring gasoline on this fire. So
that's a great point. If I could just take a second on that, we actually did some interesting research, and we looked at day-to-day ticks in anti-Muslim hate crimes after President Bush spoke 6 days after 9/11, and hate crimes dropped from 47.5% to 66%, depending on where you put the dividing timeline on that day. But after candidate Trump first proposed his Muslim ban on December 7, 2015, 5 days after the terrible attack on our community in San Bernardino, hate crimes against Muslims went up 87.5%. So in those 5 days, we had 15 anti-Muslim hate crimes that we could find in the United States. There were actual crimes and looked at using FBI criteria. And that compares to the monthly average of the previous 5 years of only 12.6. So we had over a month's worth of anti-Muslim hate crimes just in the 5 days after the Muslim ban proposal, the initial one. And that was above an already elevated number of hate crimes after the San Bernardino terrorist attack. So there appears to be a correlation that words matter.
So let's
You were at the demonstration yesterday in San Bernardino, Brian Levin, and of course, as far as we know, the rallies were spearheaded by ACT for America, which is an anti-Muslim hate group organized by a neo-Nazi, Billy Roper. There were, of course, counter-demonstrations from some of the groups, including the anti-fascist group or Antifa.
Can I make just one correction on that?
Yeah.
Just in fairness to the ACT for America folks,
yeah.
They're led by a woman named Bridget Gabriel.
Uh-huh.
Billy Roper was going to organize one, I believe, in Arkansas. Billy Roper, if I remember correctly, was the neo-Nazi who actually, I think he complimented the 9/11 attack, saying that like they had fortitude to ram a plane into a building.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had respect for that or something. I could be wrong if my memory might be murky on that, but I think that's what he said right after 9/11. Billy Roper is a neo-Nazi, and when they when ACT for America found out that he was organizing one specific event, that event was canceled and not done in their name. Just in fairness to the ACT for America folks.
Right, but now that horrible woman. In New York, I can't remember her name. Pamela Geller.
Oh, Pamela Geller.
She's not involved in that, is she? She an organizer of ACT for America?
Pamela Geller has her own website and her own anti-Muslim group.
Oh, okay.
This is one that is affiliated with a woman named Bridget Gabriel,
right.
Who is a Christian from Lebanon.
Okay.
And she has like a road show, and she's part of this very interesting industry that promotes anti-Muslim hate. And what's so interesting is, you know, we don't have this kind of organization and well-financed industry in the hate world like we do with regard to anti-Muslim bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these folks who are in it are making over $500,000 a year. Bridget Gabriel's making in the six figures doing this as well.
Wow. So, Brian,
a lot of money and hate.
A lot of money and hate. Yeah, and well, love is a lot harder than hate. We've run out of time. I was going to play a clip of you trying to talk to these people and get a flavor of their mindset. If that's not too generous a description, we've run out of time. And I thank you for joining us, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, he served as associate director of legal affairs for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he's recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.